Malcolm Honlein is in Israel. He is in the Holy Land. He's actually in the holy city of Jerusalem, and he is the executive vice chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, good afternoon to you. Good morning over here. Welcome back to JM in the AM.
Good morning, and it's great to be with you, looking out at the most gorgeous sight in the whole world from high atop the Inbal Hotel at the Old City of Jerusalem and the surrounding hills on a beautiful day in Jerusalem.
Wow, you're making everybody jealous, and that's an understatement.
I hope so. And they can solve that jealousy with one ticket.
Yeah,
it can be one way.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, during our Tu B'Shvat special on Wednesday, we were speaking about the fact how most, if not all, of the convenient excuses not to move to Israel are basically gone. You know, the economy in Israel is stronger than the economy of the United States at this point.
The economy is booming. People, there is so much going on in terms of creativity, so much going on in terms of new business initiatives. And as you said, the economy here has sustained over this period better than the American economy. And, you know, while it's certainly vulnerable to all of the vicissitudes that others are, you look at Israel as a small country, given its incredible burdens of security and everything else, and how it has done, and you see Italy on the verge of collapse, Portugal, Greece, all of them in huge problems. I think it's an important statement and something we should appreciate.
The best of
Israel.
It's an understatement to say that I'm no economist, but how does Israel maintain what you just described when they're always on the verge of a strike, and their strikes involve such a large percentage of the workforce in Israel? And while you're answering that question, let us know the update regarding the Histadrut.
You are an economist, and and I think the economists don't know the answer to these questions. Well, first of all, there was advanced planning, and there were difficult measures taken to try and build in shock absorbers for the economy. Second, you have this immense creativity with 4,200 startups, many of them every year being sold to major corporations for hundreds of millions of dollars. There is a dynamic here in the society, you know, construction people coming from abroad, and it's quite remarkable to see how much is still going on. And every time they tell me, don't worry, the prices will come down. Don't buy yet. The prices will come down. And they just keep going up.
But
the strike is very annoying.
Right.
And it doesn't affect us so much, but people, public transportation.
Right.
Someone told me that they got a call from the driver who takes their kids to school that they will be driving, but they're not sure any teachers will be at the school. And I'm not kidding. And they said, what do you do with a six-year-old when you put him in a car and he has nobody there to watch?
Malcolm, you've been to Israel. You know the best education you get is from the bus drivers.
100%.
Who needs the teachers?
Cab drivers. So there is annoyance at this. I mean, I think it's played out at a high level between the Minister of Finance and the head of the Histadrut. The airports are closed several hours during the day, which inconveniences many people, and the fear that, you know, you can have strikes for longer hours, different hours. Hopefully, it'll be resolved very quickly. It hurts Israel, costs Israel hundreds of millions of shekels a day, every day the strike is on. It is not universal, the strike.
Right.
I mean, again, as I said, those just of us visiting won't necessarily encounter it.
Right. I'll still never forget. I'm sure I've told you this a million times. I'll never forget walking in Yerushalayim, and a massive pile of garbage was on the street in the center of town under the sign that said Rehov Histadrut. And I thought that basically said it all.
You haven't told me, but that is very funny.
Is that great? And I'll move on in a second to all the big issues of the day. But just to close this out, as a younger person, I was always told, and I grew up on the theory that, you know, because of all these general nationwide strikes that, you know, affect so many people, even when they're limited, but they still affect so many in the workforce, that was one of the reasons why the economy was always stalled in Israel. That's why I'm saying that today, despite all this, recycled strike fervor every once in a while, it seems like they're able to get through that, and it doesn't affect the economy in a major way.
You're asking a very complicated question. Maybe one day we should devote a show to it and bring real experts on.
Right.
Because like you, I'm not an economist, and I never understood economics. Maybe that's because no one understands it. everybody's an expert in it. But, you know, the immense story here about farm workers, about jobs, about employment being really low, and to some degree, no unemployment, that there are jobs that people won't take, but there isn't the statistical comparison to, let's say, what's going on in the United States. And in other countries like Turkey, where the numbers are fudged, right, make the economy look a lot stronger and more robust than, in fact, it really is.
All right, very good
and
point.
You have a comparable situation to, let's say, what's in Greece and Portugal. In fact, worse, yet they put out positive numbers saying their growth is 7% or 5%. And you know that numbers, at least in Israel, reflect a true situation.
Right.
Because here you can't keep secrets.
All right, we'll move on to some of the other issues of the day. I'm not sure, but usually when you're in Israel, I ask you about, I'm sure you'll incorporate the meetings and findings that you've had over the last few days in the Holy Land into what we'll discuss chronologically. We'll start with what happened shortly after the last conversation we had. So China and Russia did not cooperate, officially did not cooperate in the United Nations when it came regarding the resolution against Syria. Now, that was expected based on what you told us last week, but now it's official. What has this done now to the United States' relationship with those two countries over the Syrian issue?
Well, it is a very serious development, and other than the obvious impact that we couldn't get the sanctions passed that the United States, the Europeans, the Arab League, and others had wanted with Russia and China, both with the veto power and Security Council voting against. And China, as a historical fact, doesn't vote alone against something. It won't veto unless someone else does it. You know, So Russia doing it enabled China to go along.
Right.
But they are doing many things to help break the impact of the sanctions, including selling weapons. Now that Russians have said that they're going to build a nuclear reactor like they did in Iran, which gains them billions of dollars in income, I guess. But, you know, to talk about selling Syria this equipment now, to talk about, not wanting to see, and in fact, like Iran and others, warning against any kind of foreign intervention, though I don't know who would intervene. The Arab League said it won't. The United States says it won't. The U.S. Europeans say it won't. Now, just think of the message this sends to every Arab leader or every leader of a terrorist entity where they see that the West is impotent,
right,
that the West can't stand up to a guy who is massacring people. Today, there was a huge explosion in Aleppo, and if you remember, I told you to watch the two cities, Damascus,
right,
and Aleppo,
right,
to know when Assad, the beginning of the end. Today, a huge explosion, maybe 25 or more people killed. The fighting in homes, the fighting in other areas, and the massing of troops, by the way, also along the Lebanese border, which is an interesting development today, but also around homes that people think that there will be a major escalation. In the meantime, the Russians are still sending weapons to these guys. I know, it's incredible to think about it. The Russian parliament, I think, today voiced strong support for what the Kremlin is doing to shield Assad. And remember, they have interests. Not only are they in the ports of Tartus and Latakia, they have invested a fortune. They forgave a vast amount of money debt owed to Russia by Syria in exchange for new arms sales. And these are massive arms sales. It's also Russia's major outpost. And the concern that their position would be diminished in the Middle East by the loss of Assad and its replacement by a regime, when they know that the opposition today is demonstrating as much against Russia, China, as they are against Assad. So you have at play a number of factors vis-a-vis the Russian and the Chinese interests. The Chinese interests aren't necessarily exactly identical to or parallel to that of Russia. The Syrians now are talking, and there's a great concern growing about the potential use of chemical weapons. There's and the model for what is happening in response to your question is that Chechnya, what the Russians did in Chechnya, is the model for what the Syrians are doing now. And the situation in Syria is something that has evolved over decades, not just in terms of the political situation and the dominance of the Assad family, but, you know, they prevented contraceptives, they banned it, and use and the trade in it. So the population grew extremely fast. You had the economy did not grow commensurate with it. You also had climate change that affected vast areas with a prolonged drought that devastated Syrian agriculture, and whole villages with thousands of people had to be abandoned. And the cities around Syria were then swelled with hundreds of thousands of these refugees who created slum areas. And, of course, as we learned in all the other events, and we have said, the first issue is the economy, not democracy.
Right, understood.
And the, you know, the what we saw in Egypt, which we should talk about, because there were additional manifestations of that.
So the advantage that Syria has over Iran, essentially, is that they have a better sponsor. In other words, Russia's ready to go, you know, ready to go the longer yard, so to speak, for Syria than for Iran. If Iran had the support of Russia the way Syria did, they'd have much more influence than they have right now.
Well, Russia has prevented the sanctions against Iran as well. They have huge investments. They sold them the nuclear reactor at Bushehr. They say they're going to build 10 more. There's billions and billions of income. They're selling lots of weapons to Iran. They are doing the same thing.
But is my premise?
And they have stymied the resolutions. What they do essentially is water them down to almost meaninglessness.
But is my premise wrong? So what is it? Just a public perception that I would think that, you know, they have a closer relationship with Syria, or would you say it's an equal sponsorship?
I would say that it's closer to equal, but the stake for Russia in Syria, in terms of its military, the fact that they brought their warship there, indicates that it is, in fact, symbolically and practically of greater significance. Lavrov, the foreign minister, went to see Assad and said, oh, he's going to work it out, meaning keep constantly buying time for them. But they did the same in regard to Iran, trying to forestall. The difference is also is that Iran is a danger to them, too. And that's something the Russians point out to me all the time. Look, it's a lot closer to us. It's on our border. Right. And them having a nuclear power, a nuclear capacity, weapons capacity, is a direct danger to us.
Right.
On the other hand, the Russians buy off the massacre in Chechnya by co-opting Iranian, Syrians, and others in the Muslim world, in the Arab world. It's not exactly parallel in terms of the risks to Russia. But the stakes are very high. The Syrians owe them billions of dollars.
You know, based on what you've told us over the last few weeks, those weapons that Russia's selling to Syria, they should just ship directly to Lebanon, because eventually they're going to end up there, right?
That is actually the Syrians could be playing the middleman. We know that some weapons, and the real concern now, as I said before, is about the chemical weapons, but it applies to others. The missiles, they have huge missile capacity, and they're getting new and more advanced missiles. I don't know where they're going to use them, because these are often fired at sea, not at on land war. But they are buying the new planes, which are used against civilian populations. And, you know, this past week, for the first time, they used aircraft against some of the protesters and areas of protest. And now we'll see, after this attack in Aleppo, with I think several dozen certainly killed and 100 or 200 wounded, we're likely to see this expand. One of the things that the opposition is saying is that these are in fact actions by Syrian forces to build a popular disgust, support for the government, and disgust at the demonstrators.
By the way, one of the things the Western media keeps focusing on is the shakiness of the future of the Putin government. First of all, is that true? And secondly, if it is really as shaky as they're saying, is that going to be helpful to the United States? Is it only a very strong Russian administration that can continue this way with Syria?
Very good question. I think that the people I've spoken to tell me that the demonstrations are real. And while I don't think Putin is immediately threatened, it certainly undermines his authority, and he can't claim the popular support that he usually asserts when he gets elected, you know, with 97% of the vote, right, or 107%. And it's also important in terms of having popular, you know, support for the actions he's taken in supporting Syria. Remember, in the Muslim world, this is not popular. They're looking every day at Arabs/Muslims being killed. And for many in the Arab world, including in places like Egypt, et cetera, and not only is Syria unpopular, Russia has become increasingly unpopular.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein is with us as we discuss the events of the week. He is live in Jerusalem. Now, I got to ask you this question, especially because you're in Jerusalem, and who knows how you were enlightened by Israeli leaders on this issue this week. When I saw this, let's see, it says here it was published February the 8th, so I guess I saw it Wednesday morning. I don't know. Maybe I just can't take it anymore. But the headline in the New York Times was U.S. and Israel split on speed of Iran threat. And I keep, you know, my position on this. I think the better thing to do is everybody completely remain silent on this issue. But these news analysts cannot stop, and they're constantly trying to get statements from Israeli and American officials about the threat of Iran. I assume that this came up in some of the meetings you had in Yerushalayim. Is there anything you could tell us about what seems to be foreign affairs' favorite topic?
I think it's a safe assumption that it came up and that we discussed it. I think that this is such a complicated area, and I happen to agree with you that I think less is more in this case, and less said would be beneficial, and especially about, you know, the point of existential threat.
Right.
This is not an existential threat to Israel. It's a threat. It could do a lot of damage. But Israel's existence, I believe, will continue. I don't believe that Iran can do it with Israel. I think sometimes it's a greater existential threat to the Gulf states, to places like Kuwait and Bahrain, which they claim, and maybe even Syria, which they have targeted and where they're trying to aggravate the situation in the eastern province where the oil is and the Shiite population, Bahrain, Egypt, other places where you've had the revolutionary situations still evolving. So there, I think that we have to be careful not to escalate the rhetoric. It's also the timetable is a matter of debate. And I think that is where what they were talking about is that the difference is not about what the nature of the threat is. Everybody
right.
understands. Every Arab country understands it and speaks about it.
The zone of immunity was the issue.
Pardon me?
The zone of immunity was the issue.
That's only one of the issues that actually has arisen. You know, we saw this week the president enacting the regulations to impose the sanctions. Well, we want to see how tough are the sanctions going to be? How comprehensive? Are we really going to go after companies and shut them down by virtue of the fact that we eliminate the ability of the Central Bank of Iran
right.
to give credits to do deals? That will have a real impact. Another thing that stimulated the discussion this week was the fact that you had the mission of the IEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is responsible for monitoring it, and it was a failure. They all admit it was a failure. They couldn't get to see the key places, and they issued statements, which we never used to see, but now under the new leadership we get the truth or closer to it, that Iran has worked on technologies to turn the nuclear fuel into weaponizing it and for warheads as well. And that they saw evidence of this. They also talked about the kind of detonators, stuff that we didn't used to hear. And the action on the bank is not only that, but the SWIFT system, which those who do banking transfers know, being denied to Syria can also. And the more that you put the pressure on the Syrians, on the Iranians, the more the hope is that somehow the people will react. And the pressure will build on them. But at the same time, India is increasing its imports and surpassed China as the number one customer. So we have to, frankly, go after Iran, after India. They have to pay a price. You know, the extremism, and not just the nuclear program, because when we focus, and we do it as well, just on that, but don't talk about the human rights record. Don't talk about the terrorism. The website of the Iran Parliamentary Research Center, the head of it,
yeah.
Had a blueprint for destroying the Jewish people this week. And it's there are people who are calling for his indictment for inciting to genocide. This is a violation of the Genocide Convention. It's not just carrying it out. It's when you incite people to carry it out. So the Iranian front has become much more complicated. Iranian officers are in Syria. They're involved in it for good reason. They're scared about what the implications of loss of Syria would be, and the more pressure we put on them, the more ways we find pressure, the more we can extend the burden and send a message that, number one, we're really committed on anything, whatever it needs to take. It's a message for Iran, and it's a message for the other countries in the region that the West can be relied upon, that the West will really act. Right now, many Arab leaders say our only hope is Israel doing what it has to do.
This is the first time, I think this week was the first time that a reputable news agency actually had some type of proof that Israel was involved in the assassination of some of the Iranian scientists. Am I right that this was the first time that there was actually some real proof?
There's some real something, but it was the Iranians who made the claim and who were putting it out. So we don't believe Iran on most things. I don't know why we should believe them on this.
So maybe
Israel has never acknowledged that it's them. They haven't said it. They in fact, and sometimes there are indications this could well have been carried out by the regime, that this was a guy who was not cooperating, who they afraid was going to defect. That way you build a public animosity and support for the regime by themselves carrying out some of these acts. Not that I'm saying that we know, just saying what some of the speculation of knowledgeable people is about the attacks. But the best thing is that you know, let them speculate who they think did it. The thing is that you put every nuclear scientist on notice that if you want to work in Iran, better have a good life insurance policy.
Yeah, that's for sure. I sometimes think it's unfair. I'm sure you're going to disagree with me on this because, you know, if someone's going to be president of the United States, they need to be able to answer all these questions. But when they ask a candidate during an interview on CNN, you know, what would you do in Syria? Like, what would you do, you know, that... I don't know. It's like it's such a complicated issue where a candidate would not even have a clue, outside of being a pundit himself, wouldn't have a clue what's really going on and what the President of the United States has to deal with at this point. Don't you find that type of question to a candidate is a little bit out there?
I do think it's, but if people are critical of one approach, then they have to be ready to offer an alternative.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what the basis for the questions are. You know, but your point is really important. People tend to look at these things in black and white terms. Iran has nuclear weapons. We can't afford to let them have it. Got to take action and bomb them. Mm. People don't know what the complications are. What is entailed in this? Are there ways to do it? I absolutely believe both Israel, the United States, others could do it. Could they do it differently? Do they disagree on when the window of opportunity or necessity closes? They have differences, but that's because people are not there walking into the centrifuge centers and seeing how many are operating, what the status is. What we have seen is that in a report, by the way, that the head of the military intelligence put out just over the last couple of days, that there are 4 tons of uranium enriched to 3% and about 100 kilos enriched to 20%. You have to get to 90% for a weapon, but that would be enough for 4 atom bombs already sitting there. And the fact that he also referenced the 200,000 missiles and rockets that are aimed at Israel from the countries around it. So Iran doesn't need to resort to a nuclear attack. It ignites Hezbollah, Hamas, Syria, others to start raining terror down. Thank God Israel can defend itself. Israel tested successfully, again, the Iron Dome and the Arrow missile system in the last 24 hours. There are all sorts of exercises going on. I think people can come here safely knowing that I don't think anything's going to happen imminently. That Israel has real challenges that it has to address in Gaza and elsewhere, but I think that they're in a position to do so. And at the same time, we have to understand and we have to educate the public about why Gaza is not a tolerable situation when 7 or 8 missiles fall in a single night and a million people live in fear. People have forgotten the last time, the 8,000 missiles that justified the attack, you know, people understood. They saw every day the reports. Now people don't see it because everybody's tired or they don't cover it and you don't have the many reporters anymore. So they don't know about the escalation of the violence or the potential that is being built up with the new weapons that are coming into Gaza and increasingly in the hands of more radical elements like Islamic Jihad and of course, Hamas, despite it's becoming a partner with Fatah, still adheres to the policies and the buildup of arms that it is always engaged in.
Malcolm Honlein, live in Yerushalayim. When I saw the Arrow missile defense system test that you referred to, when I saw that story this morning, I also saw the one on the Jerusalem Post website that the Turks, it says here, have torpedoed Israel's Navy participation in a NATO op. Ankara prevents first instance of active Israeli participation in one of the Western military alliance's operations. I assume this was a political move and not one done out of military necessity.
Absolutely. Political move. They have not participated in previous exercises since the tension with Israel escalated, and it's very regrettable. I think Turkey and Israel should be working together. Turkey's Islamist regime has increasingly raised the stakes and hardened its line. We know that, or at least there are significant reports that Erdogan, the prime minister, is very ill and may have had cancer or other things. So we don't know the long-term longevity of this particular government, but the likelihood is that you'll get somebody else from his party and they'll take over and it will continue. But the Turks have boycotted a number of instances, including refusing meetings and to attend meetings where Israel was represented.
Yeah, it's a very cold relationship at this point.
And then Mashal visited there, and Hamas's Fatah leader visited there and met with some of the terrorists who lured a 16-year-old boy across the border and killed him. And they are helping Turkey bypass the Turkey is helping Iran bypass some of the sanctions as well. And they face also serious challenges from Iran, et cetera. And when Hamas tried Turkey as well as Jordan and Qatar to set up its new headquarters, they all rejected it.
Huh.
So there's many sides to every story.
Wanted to move to Egypt in the news. So the 19 the 19 Americans are being tried as spies, or the threat is that they'll be tried as spies?
No, they are going to be tried, and the indications are that they will be tried as spies. These are people who represented NGO, non-governmental organizations. In fact, this week, a military delegation that was in Washington canceled its meetings with people on the Hill, congressmen and senators, because of the threat that because of the arrest of these people, Americans, that they might not get their $1.3 billion in military aid and the economic aid on top of that. This is seen as a very serious matter. One of the people held is Lahoud, the son of one of the members of the cabinet, I think Secretary of Transportation. This is escalating. I think the Egyptians did not handle this well, to say the least. There's an interesting study, though, that correlates to this, which is that in a poll, it showed 71% of Egyptians about a month ago said that they oppose U.S. economic aid to Egypt at a time when their economy is in collapse, when this money is so vital, and three-quarters oppose U.S. sending direct aid to civil society groups. So the crackdown is a popular move in terms of the public, the general public. It is obviously very unpopular in the United States, and I think that they'll find some way, and the United States has to help them construct some way where they can step down. But again, this is being done by the generals. When I was there, they had just started this action. They hadn't yet arrested them, but they told me that they're engaging in incitement. Their activities are not really to help build democracy, but that they're doing their things, and they warned them.
And on top of that, the Muslim Brotherhood is getting very impatient. They want them out.
And they want the generals out. Yeah. They want to take control. But I'm not sure they're going to be so happy with, given the economic situation. Everything. They want to boast control, but they don't want to have to exercise it and be responsible for the problems. And the wages are not keeping up. Food and continues to increase in price. The balance of payments that they have, their reserves, and it could be a monumental financial collapse before very long. Maybe even by the summer, according to some of the experts. And the people could turn against the Muslim Brotherhood as well, because won't be able to do what they promised to do in terms of making the changes. So you could have a tremendous clampdown or further revolution in Egypt. I think the situation has plateaued, but hasn't reached its finale. And this could certainly endanger Egyptian-U.S. relations. The Egyptians don't want to be embarrassed. They've been humiliated a lot over the last year. I think that we have to find a way to give them a ladder to climb down from this situation and to assure that people's who are going there do what they were supposed to do in terms of spreading the message of democracy or helping, but not inciting and not being seen as contributing to the instability.
I'm sure I asked you this a year ago in regard to Egypt when you were in Jerusalem about how much Jerusalem fears what's happening in Cairo, and we see a year later what happened. Now there's rumors about what's going on in Jordan, about the Arab Spring coming there. Did you get a sense from your meetings in Jerusalem that they're worried about that side?
Absolutely. This is a very critical area for Israel. They are concerned about what goes on there and helping to stabilize the king. I don't think he's in immediate danger, but I do think he is. Has a very unstable situation, and we actually will be seeing him in the near future and being in Jordan to see firsthand what's going on. This is very important for Israel. You have their various forces, including a population that's 60% Palestinians or more. You have the Bedouin. You have splits within the Bedouin tribes. You have an economy that is not good. They are getting $2.5 billion from the Gulf Cooperation Council per year, as is Morocco. But it's a question of how they use it to develop jobs and create infrastructure, not just spend it on things that satisfy people in the short run, but will build the economy for the long run. It is a difficult situation, and they feel the impact of what happens in Egypt very strongly. I know that that the Muslim Brotherhood there seems to have some relationship with Muslim Brotherhoods in the other countries, and have threatened the king in various ways. So Jordan, very, very important.
Why did it take a year to get to this point? Like, why was when the spring Arab Spring fever was rushing through every country? How did it avoid picking up such momentum in Jordan?
That's a good question. There's several reasons. One, you have a king who is a symbol, like in Morocco. Two, and a unifying force. Two, he took steps immediately, the king, to introduce reforms, to give greater involvement, even to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but in Jordan, but they sort of turned it down. By the way, the Egyptian Brotherhood in Egypt is now saying that they want their own prime minister, and they want to sack the military, appoint the government, and everything. So you see that they're making the move, as I mentioned before, for control. So Jordan tried to take steps towards a constitution. The king told me himself, he said, I'm trying reforms, but there's no culture of opposition parties and things. You have to develop that. It's not something you can impose, and it takes time to develop it. He also took steps to try and do economic reform. He fired his whole government, then fired the next government, then fired the next government. But he's taking steps, trying to be sensitive to the demands of the people, and the demonstrations so far have not been against him. There were some who demonstrated against the queen, who is a Palestinian, and they felt has too much influence, etc. You have that internal rivalry between Palestinians and Bedouins. You have, even within the groups, various rivalries.
Unbelievable. All right, next week, Malcolm's going to be traveling, so the next time we'll speak will be during our big fundraiser in a couple of weeks. That's going to be quite a chunk of time. Do you think that there will be that? Do you think much will change? Things change every 7 days, as we know, and even faster than that. But do you think on the Russian and Chinese front, when it comes to support for Syria, there'll be any major changes, or it's essentially going to be a stalemate between the U.S. and those who are demonstrating alliance to Syria?
I think there's going to be very serious challenges. We're already beginning to see some in Egypt, for instance. Bedouin kidnapped Egyptian soldiers in the Sinai, and they released some American tourists that they had captured before. We know the Syrian army is claiming, the Free Syrian Army, the defectors say they have captured about 29 Iranians fighting in Syria. Each of these things is going to escalate the tensions in the region. We're going to see every day, and that's why people have to look at them, the headlines, and step back, read the story, see if they're justified by the headlines, and look at this in the longer sweep. You can't just react to each report, even though every detail is significant, and proof of it was the story about the picture that circulated on the web showing an Israeli soldier abusing a Palestinian girl, and the name was even identified by the blogger, and it turns out, in fact, that it was a picture at a theatrical demonstration against Israel and others that was staged in Bahrain. It was not an Israeli soldier. The guy was holding an AK-47 when Israelis use M-16s. I mean, the whole thing was concocted and should have been immediately known, but it wasn't. And people all over the Internet were condemning Israel and showed this, you know, it humiliated the IDF again and showing what kind of terrible things. So you're going to see many stories. This, the situation in Syria is boiling. I think that it'll have to be extreme for them to move to the chemical weapons, but it reminds us of the stockpiles they have and how we can protect it if the government falls, or we'll have to. And second, you're going to see more developments on the Fatah-Hamas deal. Will it, in fact, move ahead? Will the divisions be too great? They didn't resume the talks in Amman with Israel now because of the pressures. We'll see if Fayyad gets a role. Right now, there's opposition to the agreement that put Abu Mazen both as prime minister and as president. This is supposed to be a government of technocrats, according to the agreement that was reached in Doha. We'll see what happens with that. As you know, it's never what it seems.
Oh, that's for sure.
And there's just so many things happening at once that people have to really take the time to try to look behind the headlines.
Malcolm, you're in Jerusalem, so please investigate that zone of immunity, if you don't mind. Check it out.
And I'll remember everyone at the Kotel tonight and to have tefillos for everybody. We hope that we'll see real shalom here and that the country will continue to prosper the way it is, and everybody will be coming here to visit.
Where's Friday night dinner tonight?
It's a secret. Secret location.
Private house, huh?
A secret location.
You're the guest of some prominent...
But it's glad.
Stay away from the controversial figures, please.
That's harder.
Do your best. All right, Malcolm Hohenlein's in Yerushalayim, and he is, of course, the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Friday morning, Erev Shabbos, Parshas Yisro, candlelighting at 5:04 on this Erev Shabbos, 5:04. There'll be no weekly update next week because Malcolm is traveling. 2 weeks from today, we'll be in the middle of our fundraising marathon 2012. So the next time we'll speak about the issues of the day will be at some point during the fundraiser here in Jersey City when Malcolm comes in and encourages everybody to support us generously and help us achieve our goal.